Welcome to the Family Farm Podcast, priority topics for family medicine and community pharmacy. Hi everyone, my name is Tina Lian and I'm a fourth-year pharmacy student at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Billy Lin. I am still a family practice resident at UBC. So we've covered hypertension and dyslipidemia. And to round out our big three, the next topic we'll cover is diabetes.
That's correct. Diabetes is a common condition in many patients today, and we find that this is a very important topic to include in our initial first few episodes.
So similar to what we did for hypertension and dyslipidemia, we'll cover the national guidelines for diabetes, and that is the CDA 2013 guideline.
So diabetes is a disease of sugar dysregulation with potentially devastating complications that affects all age groups worldwide. As of 2009, the estimated prevalence of diabetes in Canada was 6.8% of the population, and that's 2.4 million Canadians, a 230% increase compared to prevalence estimates in 1998. And by 2019, that number is expected to grow to 3.7 million.
So what are some risk factors for developing diabetes?
So common risk factors are family history, ethnicity, and that's including Asians, Hispanics, and African Americans, obesity, or central fat distribution, and this is measured by waist circumference or waist to hip circumference ratio. And lastly, birth weight. And for lifestyle risk factors, common risk factors include lack of exercise, smoking, too long or too short sleep duration, and dietary patterns, especially when there's an increased consumption of red meat, processed meat, and sugar-sweetened beverages. On the other hand, whereas consumption of a diet high in fruits, vegetables, nuts, whole grains, and olive oil, there's an associated reduced risk of type 2 diabetes.
Also, it has been found that vitamin D deficiency or iron overload or chromium deficiency could be related to increased risk for diabetes. And there are some medications that can cause glucose intolerance. And they do this by either increasing glucose production or decreasing insulin sensitivity. So when we speak of drugs, we know who we will ask.
Yeah, so I'm back again. These medications include fluoroquinolones, HIV antiretrovirals, and other anti-infectives. Also, first-generation antipsychotics, including clopromazine and phenothiazines, as well as second-generation antipsychotics such as clozapine, olanzapine, quetiapine, and risperidone. And second-generation antipsychotics appear to be more diabetogenic compared to first-generation antipsychotics. Also, some cardiovascular medications can cause glucose intolerance, for example, like beta blockers, such as propranolol or atenolol, hypolipidemic, such as niacin, and statins, thiazide diuretics like hydrochlorothiazide, chlorothiazide, and indapamide, vasodilators like diazoxide, and vasopressors, for example, like epinephrine and norepinephrine. There's also other medications, for example, glucocorticoids, sex hormones, and that includes oral contraceptives, or growth hormones. And lastly, immunosuppressants like cyclosporine.
There is also some medical conditions or in the medical history that could be associated with increased risk of diabetes, and these include gestational diabetes, other cardiovascular diseases such as heart failure and MIs, and hypertension is thought to be an independent risk factor of diabetes as well, and hyperuricemia, PCOS or polycystic ovarian syndrome, or other metabolic syndromes. And breastfeeding is associated with decreased risk of type 2 diabetes.
And I'll talk more about this later on in the treatment episode.
As we mentioned, diabetes is a disease of sugar dysregulation. And for a lot of people with diabetes, they're actually diagnosed based on their lab test. And they may not understand why treating diabetes is so important when they're asymptomatic. And the reason is that diabetes is known to cause many serious complications. And diabetes is actually the leading cause of blindness, end-stage renal disease, and non-traumatic amputations in Canada. As well, patients with diabetes is at a much increased risk for cardiovascular disease. So for patients with very high sugars or hyperglycemia, they could have classic symptoms of diabetes, which include polyuria, polydipsia, nocturia, even blurred vision and weight loss. With the modern screening of diabetes, it is actually rare to see patients with this severe of diabetic disease. And most patients, as mentioned, are asymptomatic when they're diagnosed. For screening of type 2 diabetes, for individuals greater than 40 years of age or individuals at a higher risk, they should have screening with fasting plasma glucose or A1C every 3 years. For individuals at a very high risk, such as those with multiple risk factors or individuals with a high risk score on a calculator, more frequent or earlier testing should be recommended. So to diagnose a patient with diabetes, a few different lab tests can be used. And these are the fasting plasma glucose, and that is after 8 hours of fasting, or 2-hour postprandial glucose after 75 gram oral glucose tolerance test, or hemoglobin A1C level, or random blood sugar. The threshold for diagnosis is a fasting plasma glucose of greater than or equal to 7.0 millimoles per liter, or greater than or equal to 11.1 millimoles per liter in a 2-hour postprandial glucose, or random blood glucose. Or for the hemoglobin A1C, is greater than or equal to 6.5. In an asymptomatic patient, a repeat confirmatory test will be required, but if the patient does have symptoms, then the diagnosis can be made based on one abnormal test, and the treatment should be started. So for treating diabetes, there are pharmacological and non-pharmacological treatment options. For non-pharmacological or lifestyle options, the CDA guideline focused on physical activity and nutritional recommendations. So for exercise, the CDA guideline suggests 115 minutes of moderate to rigorous intensity aerobic exercise per week, spread out every other day. And they also recommend resistant exercise at least twice a week and preferably 3 times a week. For patients with possible extensive cardiovascular disease or microvascular disease, they recommend a medical workout before the patient undertakes intense exercise that is more vigorous than brisk walking. And these could include history taking, physical exam, resting ECG, and possibly exercise ECG stress test. For nutritional recommendations, they recommend diabetic patients to talk to a dietitian to lower their A1C levels, and they recommend following Canada's food guide as a tool to plan their diet. For overweight or obese people with diabetes, they should use a diet plan to try to reduce their calorie intake and maintain a lower body weight. Dietary advice may emphasize choosing carbohydrate food sources with a low glycemic index. They identified a few alternative dietary patterns which may be used in people with type 2 diabetes, and these are Mediterranean diet, a vegan or vegetarian diet, or the DASH diet. As you may have noticed, there is a recurring theme in terms of diet for hypertension, dyslipidemia, and diabetes. And all the major national guidelines recommend the Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet, as well as the Canada Food Guide, may be a good source of dietary information. For patients using insulin or insulin secretagogues, they should be educated about delayed hypoglycemia, and this could result from alcohol consumption with or after previous evening's meal. And they should be advised on preventive actions such as carbohydrate intake and or insulin dose adjustments, and increased blood glucose monitoring. Okay, so for pharmacological treatment, the CDA 2013 guideline separated the patient into 3 groups. The first group are those with A1C less than 8.5%, and for these patients and for all the other patients, they should start with lifestyle intervention. But for these patients, it's reasonable to just try lifestyle management for the first 2 to 3 months before initiating metformin. Alternatively, they could start with metformin with their lifestyle management and then follow up within 2 to 3 months. The second group of patients are those with A1C greater than or equal to 8.5, and these patients should start with metformin right away. And if their A1C is actually too high, then you can consider a combination therapy with another anti-hyperglycemic agent. The third group of patients are those with symptomatic hyperglycemia or metabolic decompensation. And these patients should start with insulin plus or minus metformin. Once again, everyone should have lifestyle intervention, including nutritional therapy and physical activity. For patients who do not meet glycemic target, it's recommended that they should add a second agent based on their individual characteristics. And these are their degree of hyperglycemia, risk of hypoglycemia, overweight or obesity, comorbidities such as renal, cardiac, or hepatic diseases, or the patient preferences and access to treatment. And the second-line agents will have different characteristics that match the patient's characteristics. And different agents have differing blood glucose-lowering efficacy and durability, risk of inducing hypoglycemia, effect on weight, and different contraindications and side effects, as well their cost and coverage status. Second-line agents include alpha-glucosidase inhibitors, or ACARBOs, or incretin agents, including the DPP-4 inhibitors, or the GLP-1 receptor agonists, or insulin secretagogue, including meglitinide, or sulfonylurea, or the TZD medications. And Tina, the pharmacy student, will include a future podcast on detailing these classes of medications. Now, for our pharmacy listeners, especially for Tina's classmates in fourth year, your licensing exam may be based on the sixth edition of Therapeutic Choices, and their section on diabetes is actually based on the CDA guidelines in 2011, and they have slightly different targets, and Tina can go over those quickly.
Yep. So for A1C cutoff, instead of 8.5% in the 2013 guideline, the one used in Therapeutic Choices 6th edition is 9%. So it's suggested that for patients with an A1C over 9%, they should initiate pharmacotherapy immediately, consider metformin with another agent, or initiate insulin.
A quick note on starting insulin is that when based on insulin is added to the mix, long-acting analogs such as Detemir or glargine should be used instead of the intermediate-acting NPH to reduce the risk of nocturnal and symptomatic hypoglycemia. And for all individuals with type 2 diabetes currently using or starting therapy with insulin or insulin secretagogues, should be consulted about the prevention, recognition, and treatment of drug-induced hypoglycemia. Okay. So for vascular protection for patients with diabetes, you should consider the ABCDES. And A stands for A1C, which is optimizing glycemic control to less than or equal to 7% for most patients. And the B stands for BP, which is optimizing their blood pressure control. And from our previous episode on hypertension, Tina, this is a quiz question. What is the blood pressure control target?
I think I know what it is. It's less than 130 over 80 mmHg.
That is correct, and that is based on the CHEP guideline that we summarized earlier. And the C stands for cholesterol, and do you remember that one?
I'll let our listener to think about it for a little while.
Dun, 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 dun.
LDL less than 2.0 millimoles per liter.
Oh, very good, and that is based on the CCS guideline from 2012. And the D stands for drugs. And these are the ACE inhibitors or ARBs, the statins or the ASAs if they're indicated. And we'll talk about these a little bit later. So we cover A, B, C, D, and the E is exercise, basically a healthy lifestyle in terms of physical activity, healthy diet, and ideal body weight. And finally, the S stands for smoking cessation. So in terms of statins, ACE inhibitors or ARBs or aspirin, which patients require these medications? And there are a few things you need to consider. So the first thing is, does the patient have end organ damage? So if they have macrovascular disease, such as cardiac ischemia, peripheral artery disease, or cerebrovascular disease, then you should start statins plus an ACE inhibitor plus an aspirin. And if they cannot tolerate aspirin, then clopidogrel is a reasonable substitute. If the patient has microvascular disease, and these are retinopathy, nephropathy, or neuropathy, then they should start with statins and ACE inhibitors. Now, the second thing you need to consider is what is the patient's age. If they're greater than or equal to 55 years of age, then they should be on statins plus an ACE inhibitor. If they're between 40 to 54 years of age, they should be on a statin. Now, the third thing to consider is
whether or not the patient has a long-standing diabetes. This means greater than 15 years of diabetes and age greater than 30 years, or if they should be on statin therapy anyway, based on the 2012 CCS guideline. Then, of course, they should be on statins. Now, you may have noticed that I said the target of A1C is 7.0% for most patients, and that means there are some exceptions. So we would consider relaxing the target to just below 8.5% if the patient has limited life expectancy, if they have high level of functional dependency, if they have extensive coronary artery disease and that they're at a high risk of ischemic events, or if they have multiple comorbidities, history of recurrent severe hypoglycemia, or hypoglycemia unawareness, or someone who is just difficult to treat to achieve an A1C of less than 7% despite effective doses of anti-hypoglycemic agents. On the other side of the equation, if the patient wants to further lower their risk of microvascular disease in terms of nephropathy and retinopathy, they could consider a stricter target of less than or equal to 6.5%. But this must be balanced against the risk of hypoglycemia. So the next section is a little bit more medical than pharmaceutical, and this is pertaining to regular follow-up for patients with diabetes. Now, you have a patient with diabetes, and you're wondering what you should do for diabetic annual screens. Well, this depends on if the patient has type 1 or type 2 diabetes. For type 1 diabetes, screening is usually done after 5 years of disease duration and then annually. And these include chronic kidney disease, retinopathy, and neuropathy. And for patients with type 2 diabetes, they should be screened at diagnosis and annually. To screen for chronic kidney disease, the test of choice is urine ACR and serum creatinine. A normal ACR is less than 2.0 milligrams per millimole, and a normal eGFR is greater than 60 mils per minute. For retinopathy, they should be screened with an eye specialist. For a neuropathy or foot exam, they should be screened with a monofilament or a tuning fork. And the foot exam should look for structural abnormalities, neuropathy, vascular disease, ulcerations, and infections. As well, patients with diabetes should be screened regularly for coronary artery disease and dyslipidemia. And these can be done with history taking, physical exams, and proper lab tests. So that concludes our summary of the CDA guidelines on diabetes. I included the sections that I think are most relevant to family practice residents and pharmacy students. There are a lot of other tools. Actually, they develop a lot of apps that doctors and pharmacists can use on their website. And we'll post a link to their website so that you can explore these guidelines and their tools in more detail. For our next episode, Tina, the student pharmacist, will include further discussion on all the anti-hypoglycemic agents. So until then, thank you for listening.
And we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Family Farm Podcast. Please leave your feedback and check out our show notes at fppodcast.org.